This is Dr. Ted Hildebrandt in his Old Testament History, Literature, and Theology course, lecture number 15 on the book of Numbers.
Okay, class, let's get started. For next week, you guys are working on the book of Judges and Ruth. And so Judges and Ruth kind of go together. There'll be articles. I think there's an article. We may be back to Our Father Abraham, and there'll be memory verses. So largely it'll be Judges, Ruth, articles, the normal routine that we go through and things. So get that down, and we'll make progress then with the book of Judges and Ruth. And that'll be setting us up. It's kind of a transition period that we'll be transitioning to the monarchy after that. So today we've got a lot to go through, so we'll be hitting the book of Numbers. We're going to be hitting some pretty interesting and difficult concepts today. And so let's kind of jump into it. Numbers chapter 12. Numbers chapter 12. Let me just read this to you. And it's regarding this interracial marriage, interracial dating. By the way, I realize in our culture now is the interracial thing is not a big deal in our culture. But it has been in the past at various times. And it has been in the past for ancient Israel. So here we are in Numbers 12. And it says, Miriam and Aaron began to talk against Moses because of his Cushite wife. Now, what is a Cushite wife? The land of Cush is generally said to be the land of Ethiopia. And what color are folks from Ethiopia? Black, okay, from Ethiopia. And so Moses' brother and sister, Miriam and Aaron, both older than he was, I remember his older sister when he was a baby and getting floated down, his older sister taking care of him and things, Aaron, his older brother. And so Aaron and Miriam began to talk against Moses because of his Cushite wife, for he had married a Cushite. Now, some people think that's Ethiopia, that Moses had remarried. Do you remember that his wife took off on him after the circumcision of the son? His wife disappears from the narrative. Some people think she went back home, and that Moses remarried someone else, and there was a Cushite that he remarried. Other people think that this is Zipporah, that in other words, Miriam and Aaron had not really met Zipporah very much, and therefore they were upset because she was a Midianite. Now, she was Jethro the Midianite. She was a Midianite, but Midianite can be cast as Cushite. Cushite's a bigger category. Midianite is like a tribal name. So it's possible this is Zipporah. In either case, I'm going to suggest she's dark-skinned, okay? And that's part of the issue here. And so Cushite definitely, I mean, is Ethiopia. They say, has the Lord spoken only through Moses, they asked, and hasn't he spoken through us? The Lord heard this. And at once the Lord said to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, come out of the tent of meeting, all three of you. So the three of them came out, and the Lord came down in a pillar of cloud, and he stood at the entrance of the tent and summoned Aaron and Miriam, and both of them stepped forward, and he said to them, listen to my words. And then let me just see if we've got this. So what does the Bible say about this topic of interracial marriage and Moses and his Cushite wife? So this kind of sets it up. But then God switches this discussion here to their prophetic function because Miriam and Aaron are challenging Moses. And the Lord said, listen to my words. When a prophet of the Lord is among you, I reveal myself to him in visions. How does God reveal himself to a prophet? In visions. And he says, I reveal myself to him in visions. I speak to him in dreams. So are we going to see the prophets dreaming dreams, and are we going to see the prophets in visions? What's the difference between dreams and visions? Dreams are at night when you're asleep. Visions are what? When you're wide awake and you see a vision. Okay, so those two. And that's how God deals with prophets. But then notice what he says here. I reveal myself to him in visions. I speak to him in dreams. But this is not true with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. With him I speak face to face. So God says, with prophets I use dreams and visions. But with Moses we go tete-a-tete, pene al pene. We go face to face. Is that a pretty big statement about Moses? Is Moses a unique prophet in like the Bible, really, that God goes to him head to head, face to face and stuff? With him I speak face to face, clearly and not in riddles. He sees the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? And so God rebukes Miriam and Aaron for what they did. Now, this raises another question here, and I want to suggest to you that there's kind of an ironic justice here, and there's kind of some irony here. And the anger of the Lord burned against them, and he left them. And when the cloud lifted above the tent, in other words, a cloud came down, the cloud lifted above the tent, there stood Miriam, leprous, like snow. And what you say, Hildebrand, why do you say that's ironic justice? Here's my take on this. Miriam gets upset with Moses' black wife. And God says, Miriam, you like white? Miriam, you like white? Okay, I'll make you white, Miriam. I'll make you real white. And turns her skin leprous, white as snow. Okay? And so I think there's a play on this thing here. God says, okay, you like white? I'll make you solid white, man. And she becomes leprous. And so I just take that as a humorous thing. Okay, irony, whatever, however you want to do that. Why wasn't Aaron struck with anything? Aaron doesn't get it here. And some people have said, why does he pick on Miriam? Is it possible Miriam was the main spokesperson? It's possible Miriam is the main spokesperson, but is it also possible that what's the problem with Aaron getting leprosy? Aaron is a what? He's not just a priest. Is Aaron the high priest? I mean, he's the man, right? Aaron's the high priest for the nation and stuff. If he gets leprosy, that's no good. I mean, it affects the whole nation and stuff. So Miriam gets the leprosy, and Aaron, you know, is kind of in a certain sense thrown off the hook or whatever, but he's rebuked actually by God. But anyway, so this is just a passage with the interracial marriage. And so what I'm saying is be careful about condemning interracial marriage. Aaron and Miriam did it, and it was pretty serious, the consequences God got on their case. Now, there's a verse I skipped here, and I want to kind of raise it. I skipped verse 11, chapter 12, verse 3. This verse is used to show that Moses did not write the Pentateuch, okay? That Moses could not have written this verse. In chapter 12, verse 3, it says this, in the midst of this conflict between Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, you get the statement, Now, who's writing this? I'm suggesting that Moses is writing this stuff. And here's the statement. Could Moses have written this? Now, Moses was a very humble man. Ow, Moses is writing. Now, Moses was a very humble man. Does something strike you about that? That's like, people have conflicts with, they said, how could Moses write that? Is that a very arrogant statement? Now, Moses was a very humble person. By the way, what is the nature of humility and what is the nature of pride? Pride, very easy. Is pride easy to see in somebody else? Is it easy to see pride in somebody else? Is it almost impossible to see in yourself? Okay? Pride is very easy to spot in somebody else, very difficult to see inside yourself, which means then that if the pride is an issue, are you going to discover it yourself? Probably not. What do you need to help you? Yeah, now here's the religious answer, the Holy Spirit. That's a good answer. Do you need a friend? Would a friend be able to tell you whether you're proud and arrogant? Would a friend be able to see it in you? Once upon a time, I asked my wife that question. It's the last time I asked that question. She told me the truth. Does she know me? Yes, she does. And she just basically, I was thinking, you know, we have this wonderful, loving relationship. She'd be kind and gentle and stuff. She pulled out both guns and bam, that was the last time I asked that question. But what I'm saying is, it was most likely she got it right. Can she see the contours of pride and arrogance in me? The answer is yes. So I'm saying is, you have to have ears to hear of good friends telling you stuff. And you know what I'm saying? So be careful about pride and humility. Now Moses writes a statement. Now Moses was very humble. Is it possible for a humble person to know that they're humble? I suppose that's possible. Then let me read the rest of the verse. Now Moses was a very humble person, more humble than anyone else on the face of the earth. Say, Hildebrand, it's okay. He could know he's humble, but more humble than anyone else on the face of the earth? You got to be kidding me. Is that an arrogant statement? Now you say, well, God told him to write it, and so he just wrote it down. Okay? All right, so how do you work with this verse? Some people would say that Moses could never have written this verse, okay? This verse doesn't come from the pen of Moses and things. It would be odd from the pen of Moses. Is it possible that Joshua could be writing here? By the way, is Joshua going to finish the book of Deuteronomy? Where is Moses at the end of Deuteronomy? He's dead. From what I've been told, it's pretty hard to write when you're dead. So Moses didn't write the ending of the book of Deuteronomy, as Joshua probably wrote the end of the book of Deuteronomy. Is it possible that Joshua went through these narratives and made comments at points? And so, by the way, is it very possible that Joshua could have said Moses was the most humble man on the face of the earth? Is it possible that Joshua would have looked up to Moses and Moses was like his mentor and things like that? So that's a very likely statement from the book, from the person of Joshua. So that's possible. So that, and by the way, the NIV puts it in brackets. The NIV puts it in brackets just to say it may have been an insert from Joshua or something like that. Here's another way to look at it. So could a humble person write this? We've asked that question before. Is humility really the issue? Is humility really the issue? He's being attacked by his brother and sister. Is humility really the issue? I'm not sure humility is really the issue. And there's another way to translate this. This word oni can also be translated. Another way of looking at it is to translate it not humble, but that Moses was more oppressed. The word that's translated humility here can also be translated oppressed. Let me read this verse like this now with the word oppressed in there instead of humility, and the word can mean either thing. Now, Moses was very oppressed man, more oppressed than anyone else on the face of the earth. Could Moses have written that statement? Yeah. Moses is saying, the people of Israel are on my case. I'm sick and tired of these people asking me for food, for water. I can't take this. The people is one thing. Now, my brother and sister are on my case. And so now even my own family is doing this to me. And so Moses was feeling more oppressed. And so if you take it in the sense of oppressed, then it fits Moses and it fits the context here really well. And so to be honest with you, I like that translation. Now what's the problem? If your NIV, your NRSV, your King James all say humility, and Hildebrand says oppressed, which one's right? Somebody's saying, let me see here. Actually, you realize Dr. Wilson did part of the NIV, okay? And Wilson's never wrong. And that's just about the truth. That's the honest truth. But what I'm saying is, I get to back off. So I'm saying it can be translated humility. It is translated humility. But I've seen article out and stuff where the guy goes for oppressed. And frankly, the guy convinced me. So I think it's oppressed, but I could be wrong. You know what I'm saying? All the other translations go humility. So I got to have a little humility here myself and back off. But I do think oppressed fits the context better. So you see what I'm saying? So I give it about a 60-40, okay? You know what I'm saying? I'm not saying this dogmatically. I think it's probably right, but it's very, I could be wrong too. But I think I like it because I think it fits the context better and that kind of thing. Okay. Now, we're entering chapters 13 and 14. This is after Numbers chapter 12, Moses, humble man on the face of the earth. Chapter 13 and 14, Moses is going to send out spies into the land. And these chapters 13 and 14 are huge chapters in the Old Testament. This is like absolutely huge because they're going to go out and spy out the promised land. Remember, you guys are the nation of Israel. You guys are Jordan, Sea of Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea. You guys are Israel. You guys are the Mediterranean Sea. They're sending out spies from a place called Kadesh Barnea. Kadesh Barnea is down over here in the Sinai Desert. And they're sending the spies up into the promised land right to here. Well, his fellow is scratching his neck. That guy, sorry. But he's Hebron, okay? They're going to come up to Hebron, and they're going to get these grapes, these phenomenal Hebron grapes that are good even till this day. They're going to come back carrying these grapes back from the promised land around Hebron and things. And so let's just kind of go through. There's some questions then on this spying out of the promised land. There's some questions that I want to ask of the text in Numbers chapters 13 and 14. First question is, can God change? Can God change? Okay? If God is perfect, how can he change? Can God change? Is God static or is God dynamic? Dynamic would have more of the sense of change. Static would have the sense that God is more fixed. He can't change and stuff. So God is he static or is he dynamic? What does the text say? What does the text say? If he can't change, if God can't change, is it possible for him to think or interact? How does God think or interact with people if he can't change? is part of change when you go back and forth talking to people, that you change and you interact and that kind of a thing. How is relationship possible with someone who never changes? What never changes? Have you ever had a relationship with a rock? Did you ever have a pet rock and stuff? You can talk all you want to the rock. You can, you know, pet the rock and be nice to the rock and dress the rock up and all sorts of stuff and stuff. But it's still a rock. I mean, you know what I'm saying? The rock never changes and stuff. And so after you're all done with the rock, you said the rock is still the rock. And you've talked to the rock and it doesn't, you know, do anything. Yeah. Now, what's that? No, I don't. Explain. Now, he's got to explain it to me now. So, okay. Wilson and Castaway. And
it was a volleyball. I mean, yes.
Have you ever seen Castaway?
No, I never see Castaway. Anyways, I need to watch more movies. So you think I need to watch Castaway then? I need to watch Castaway.
Totally do.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I'll write that down, and we'll watch Castaway. All right. Sorry. Okay. Man, it's really bad when you miss. He's got a point, the major point, and I miss it because I haven't seen the movie. All right. How do you have a relationship with something that doesn't change? Okay. It's a problem, right? I don't care what movie. If the guy never changes, it's going to be a problem. Okay. So here we go. If he's dynamic, if God, you say, okay, God does, you know, interact with people. If he is dynamic, in what sense or areas is he dynamic? Is everything up for grabs? I mean, can God change everything? God gets up one morning, he says, you know something? You know, I've been good all my life, man. It's just, you know, being good is like really boring, you know, and stuff. I want to have an exciting day. You know, maybe I'm going to try to be bad today, you know, and I can be bad and have some excitement in my life and things. And so God decides one day, I'm going to be bad. Okay, can God do that? It kind of goes back to those very philosophical questions. Are there some things God can't do? Can God make a rock so big that he can't pick it up? Can God make a rock so big that he can't pick it up? And you say, wow, that's just brilliant. There must not be a God then, because God can do anything. But if he can't make a rock so big that he can't pick it up, then there's something he can't do. Do you get in the, do you understand? All it is in the question is the contradiction embedded in the question. The contradiction's embedded in the question. So it's a dumb question is basically what it amounts to. Okay. But can God change everything? Can God change everything about himself? Or are there certain things that God can't change within himself? Okay. And how do you work with that? Does God still experience choice? Can God make a choice in the now? Can God make a choice now? You say, well, Hildebrandt, what does now mean for God? You know, and we're in this thing with time and God. But can God make a choice now? Or did God make all his choices before the foundation of the world? And therefore, all God's choices were made before the foundation of the world. And now he's just trucking through. I made these choices a long time ago. And so I know it's going to be this, 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 and this. And God's just going through, you know, doing what he chose a long time ago. Can God choose now? Can God choose now, or were all the choices made in ages past? So these are some kind of questions that come up with this. Now, here's the story. Numbers chapter 13. Giants in the land. Was Moses wrong for sending out spies into the land? Someone once told me that Moses was wrong for sending out the spies into the land because he should have just trusted God. He should have just trusted God and went up there and took the land without sending out the spies. Why is that? That's not right, because in Numbers chapter 13, it says, the Lord said to Moses, send some men to explore the land of Canaan. Who told Moses to send the spies out? God did. So Moses was not wrong. By the way, would Joshua send out spies himself into Jericho? You guys just read that. Joshua sent out spies, and then they went and took Jericho. So there's nothing wrong. Just because one serves God doesn't mean you have to be dumb, you know? So you send out spies to spy out the land, to see how you're going to take the territory and stuff. So this God told them to send out the spies. When the spies go out, what do they see? Beautiful land, chapter 13, verses 26 and following. They go out and they see a land flowing with milk and honey. I love this phrase. Have you ever heard this phrase before, the land flowing with milk and honey? I always get a kick out of that, because when people hear the word milk, you guys think cows. Question, how do cows do in the desert? Okay, when it's talking about milk, is it talking about cow's milk? No. What kind of animals do you have in the desert? Goats. So when it's talking about milk, it's talking about goat's milk, not cow milk, goat's milk. And when it talks about honey, you guys are thinking this nice honey you pour out of the jar, and it's all sweet honey and stuff. A lot of people think that this honey, this halav is goat's milk, davash is honey. A lot of people think it's date jam. In other words, they take the dates and they beat it into a jam that's really sweet, we talked about before, and that this is actually goat's milk and date jam. But the problem is, if you tell Americans they go up to the promised land of goat's milk and date jam, everybody's going to say, man, I don't want to go up there. Let's stay down here and go to McDonald's, something. So anyways, but that's actually probably, the honest truth is that's probably more like it, goat's milk and date jam. The goat's milk for sure, because cows, you understand, you don't take cows. The deserts, cows are up in Bashan in the very well-watered area up there. They do have cows, but mostly up in Bashan, yeah. Halav v'davash. It says milk and honey. Now the question is, what kind of milk is it? And all I'm saying is cows, probably not, most of the milk they drink is goat's milk. And davash, which can be translated honey, but it also can mean this a date composite thing. And it may be that, because they're coming out, there's a lot of palm trees. They're down at Kadesh Barnea. Actually, I should tell you a story about Kadesh Barnea. Once upon a time, I went to Israel, and I was developing this program called Get Lost in Jerusalem. So, but don't laugh, you'll be doing this Get Lost in Jerusalem in 1st and 2nd Samuel. I'll take you to Jerusalem, virtual reality. So my son, we're shooting these pictures, and we went down then along here. This is Israel. We were down in the south by Egypt, and we pulled up to a checkpoint, which basically was, Egypt was on the other side, Israel was on this side, and the Israeli soldiers came up and they said, and I said, we want to drive down this road. There was a road that went down, and I wanted to drive down that road because up on this road, there was about a 2,000 high foot mountain that I could climb up and I could get a picture of Kadesh Barnea. Now, why is Kadesh Barnea so significant? Because there's a huge spring there, and the Israelites, when they wandered for 40 years in the wilderness, where did they wander? Kadesh Barnea, right there. And I could get a picture from it up on this mountain. Even though it's in Egypt, I could shoot it down. It's about 20 miles down. I could get a picture of it. So we pull up to the checkpoint, and the guy says, hey, I can't let you in there because you either have to have an Israeli soldier with you, which we didn't have, or you got to have a gun, which we didn't have. So I thought, oh, stink, I came all the way from America. This guy's not letting me in there. I know that road goes down there. And so my son and I, we back up the road. We go about half mile down the road, and I look, and I see this dirt road going off to the side. And I thought, I'll bet you anything, that dirt road goes around that checkpoint. And I thought, nuts on this, man. I didn't come all the way from America. I'm going to do this. So we get in this little car going down this dirt road, man, the rocks all over the place, bouncing and stuff. We get up, and guess what? It went right around the checkpoint. They never saw us. We got on this, it's a one-lane road, one lane. And there's not two lanes, one lane. You wonder, okay, we drive about, I don't know, it's about 50 miles down. We get up on this mountain, and I got the shot of Kadesh Barnea. I got it. Now, as we're going down, the Egyptian soldiers are driving back and forth on their Humvees, and they've got machine guns on the top of their... My son's screaming at me, Dad, we're going to get killed. These guys got machine guns are right there. They can shoot us. We're under 50 yards, It just... And so he's freaking out about these guys with their machine guns. They didn't shoot at us. We got there. We got the picture and stuff. So then he was razzing me about these machine guns and getting shot. So I thought, he's desperately afraid of heights, and I know that. And there's no guardrails on this road. And this road is literally 8 feet wide. That's the whole road. So we go up on this mountain, and I come to this place, and I notice there's like a 300-400 foot drop. So I pull the car up right on the edge of it, and I pop out like I'm going to get a picture. And I say, hey, Zach, get out. Let's get a picture. He opens the car door, and it's 400 feet straight down, man. You said you wouldn't do that to your kid. I've been there, did that, man. And you just see the tear on his face. He looks down, man, straight down. And he's just, he pulls in. There's no guardrails, so this place is dangerous and stuff. So that, anyways, then the real problem was, that wasn't the real problem. That was just for fun, okay? Now, what happens is, you drive, it's about 150 miles down, and now what the real problem is, I come up to the checkpoint, but the checkpoint down below Beersheba. Now, what's the problem? On which side of the checkpoint am I now? I come down the road and I pull up to the checkpoint. The only problem is I'm on the do not trespass territory and I'm on the wrong side of the checkpoint and I pull up. So here's what you do when you're caught. And I thought, oh man, we are so fried. I mean, this is really bad because now we got to get out, but they won't let us out because we're in this no trespass zone kind of thing. So that's when you play the really stupid American. I'm just a dumb American. And so we pull up to the guy and I said, can anybody tell, is Beersheba around here someplace? Well, Beersheba's here. Obviously, I know the land like the back of my hand. So is Beersheba around here someplace? And the guy looks at me, what do you mean Beersheba and stuff like that? I said, well, we must be lost. I said, we can't find our way. Beersheba, how do we get that? Beersheba and stuff. And the guy, and then by the way, I understand Hebrew. Question, can I hear him talking in Hebrew to these other guys? I can understand everything he's saying. He thinks I'm a dumb American. I can hear him. Well, it wasn't too good what he said. But anyways, so then the sergeant guy pulls up and he says, well, I'm going to Beersheba. You can follow me. I says, okay, thank you, thank you. So we pull up on this guy's tail and then went up and anyways, got out of that mess and stuff. But that was pretty tricky, actually. And that wasn't too much fun. Yeah, Heather?
Dr. Hildebrand, you don't like that your children are rebels.
Just maybe because of the corny way I raise them and stuff. Anyways, my son's doing all right. Well, I shouldn't say that, but actually, when you guys get to the Get Lost in Jerusalem program, he was 16 years old, and he wrote the gaming section of that program. I taught him how to program, and he wrote the gaming section of the program, actually, when he was 16 years old. So I'm really proud of him. He's out now. Anyways, the salary that he makes my wife get mad that I'm making more. Anyways, he's doing very well. He's out in Denver as a software engineer out there now. And he's not, I would say, of all my kids, he's an introvert like his father is. He's not a rebel. The rebel is my youngest son, who's a Marine. And that's much more serious. But anyways, that's a different story. And I'm on tape. I better get out of here. Okay, so the accusation then comes. Let me first go back to this then. So they come up from Kadesh Barnea into the land. They see Hebron. They bring back all these grapes saying the fruit of the land is wonderful. It's a land flowing with milk and honey. But what's the problem? They got grasshopper vision. They said basically in chapter 13, verse 33 or thereabouts, it says this. And they said basically, we seemed like grasshoppers to these Nephilim and Rephaim. Do you remember these giants that are in the land? The Rephaim and the Nephilim are up there, and we seem like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we look the same to them. These people are so big, they will crush us like grasshoppers. They're giants up there. We can't go up there and take the land. They're giants up there. And so they basically bail out. And so then comes the accusation against God. By the way, while the 12 spies went up there, who are the only two that didn't bail out? These names are important. Caleb and Joshua. Caleb and Joshua. Will Joshua take over for Moses after Moses passes off the scene? Caleb, did you guys read anything about Caleb in the book of Joshua?
Yeah.
Do you remember Caleb got his own land? All the other people over 40 are going to die. Caleb, I call him the dog man. Caleb means dog. He's dog man. Is this guy like a fighter? And do you remember even in his old age, he went out there, he was like 75 years old, he says, I'm going to go out and take the land like when I was a kid and stuff. And so he comes, even when he's an old land man taking over his territory, he's ready to fight for his land. So he is a real courageous kind of person, Caleb and Joshua, the two. And God blesses both Caleb and Joshua. But the people come up with this accusation against God in chapter 14, verses 3 and 4. Check this out. Why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to let us fall by the sword? Our wives and children will be taken as plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt? And they said to each other, we should choose a leader and go back to Egypt. By the way, does God get frosted at them for this, bailing out on them? When they're ready to enter the promised land, they would not trust him to go into the land and they want to bail out and go back to Egypt and things. Okay? Now, what does God's response? What is God's response? Joshua and Caleb, as we said, Joshua and Caleb, men of courage, men of vision. And they say, we can go up there, we can do it by the strength of the Lord. And they got voted down and things. And so, does the minority always wrong? Here you got the minority, 2 against 12, 2 against 10. and the minority was right here. They should have gone up into the land. Joshua and Caleb are blessed by God. But now what's the problem? Does God get torqued at the people? God's response, chapter 14, verse 11. The Lord said to Moses, notice how he does it. He does it in rhetorical questions. Here's God now coming on with a rhetorical question. How long will these people treat me with contempt? How long will they refuse to believe in me in spite of all the miraculous signs? If only I could see God do a miraculous sign, I would believe in God for the rest of my life. You ever thought that? If only God would do a miracle in my day, that I could see a miracle from God, I'd believe in him the rest of my life. Question, did these people see the miracles of God? Yes. Did they believe in God? No. Even with miracles, human beings don't believe in God. They had the miracles all over the place. Manna every day, water from a rock. They still would not believe in God. How long will they refuse to believe in me in spite of all the miraculous signs I have performed among them? And then God says this, I will strike them down with a plague and destroy them. But I will make you, Moses, into a nation greater and stronger than they. And Moses says, God, these people have been a pain in my backside too. Do it, man. Go for it, God, and make me into a nation. That's a great idea, God. I like that. No, wrong Moses, okay? What does Moses do? Moses then disagrees with God. Does God say he's going to strike the nation down? God says, I'm going to strike the nation down, and Moses, I'm going to make you into a nation greater than they are. That's what God says. Verse 12, God says, I'm going to strike them down. I'm going to make a nation greater than you are, largely as a result of their unbelief and holding God in contempt. But now what's Moses' reaction? God's reaction. Whoops, I'm sorry. How does Moses argue with God? Moses actually argues with God. God says, I'm going to wipe them out. Moses says this. Moses said to the Lord, then the Egyptians will hear about it. By your power, you brought these people up from among them, and they will tell the inhabitants of the land about it. Then let me jump down to verse 16. And the Egyptians will say, the Lord was not able to bring these people into the land he promised them on oath, so he slaughtered them in the desert. In other words, Moses is saying, God, your reputation's at stake. The Egyptians are going to say, hey, God brought them out of Egypt, good enough, but he couldn't bring them into the promised land, so he killed them in the desert because God wasn't strong enough to bring them into the land. So God, if you destroy them in the desert, that's what the Egyptians are going to conclude. Your reputation's on the line here. And then Moses continues. Then the second part of his argument, he says, now may the Lord's strength be displayed just as you declared. God, your mighty, your strength, declare it. Here is your strength, God. The Lord is slow to anger, abounding in hesed, abounding in loyal love, and forgiving sin and rebellion. Now, where does the statement where he said, God is slow to anger, abounding in love? Does anybody remember when Moses was hid in the cleft of the rock that God passed by and it was said that God was slow to anger, abounding in love? Moses is quoting that back to God here. And so what you get is Moses is saying, God, you can't destroy them because of your character. Your character is one who is slow to anger, slow to love. You're a forgiving and a loving God. You can't destroy them because of your character and your reputation. So Moses is praying to God. And then what happens? Down in verse 20, we see what happens. God does not strike them down. God does not strike them down. Verse 20, God says this, and the Lord Yahweh replied, I have forgiven them as you asked. I have forgiven them. God says in verse 20, I have forgiven them, Moses, as you asked me to do. Does prayer make a difference? Does prayer make a difference? God says, and let me read the verse explicitly, the Lord replied, I have forgiven them as you asked. Nevertheless, as surely as I live, and as surely as the glory of the Lord fills the whole earth, not one of the men who saw my glory and the miraculous signs I performed in Egypt will go in. So that means that they wander for 40 years until all the older people that are over 40 die. Yeah, all the older people die, 40 years in the wilderness, and anybody that saw it coming out doesn't. And does the next generation go into the land with Joshua? You guys just read that. The next generation goes in. The old generation died out. Did God strike them down, or did he spare them as Moses? He says, I spared them as Moses asked. This raises the question, another question, about the nature of forgiveness. Is it possible to be forgiven, and yet there's still consequences? Is it possible to be forgiven, and yet there's still consequences? When I was younger, I thought, well, you're forgiven, and all the consequences just evaporate, so that you don't have to face the consequences. You do stuff, and you just pray to God for forgiveness, and God lets you go. There's no consequences. Remember I told you guys the story about the time my brother stabbed me and stuff in the arm? Okay, now question, did I forgive my brother? No. Did I forgive my brother? And the answer is, yeah, I forgave him, okay? But question, was there still a scar in my arm? Yeah, okay. So in other words, it was forgiven, but were there still consequences? It's kind of like I told you about my friend Eric. There's a drunk guy who kills a young person, okay? The drunk kills a young person. Is it possible for the parents to forgive the drunk that killed their son? It's possible for parents to forgive the person. Question, is the son still dead? Do the consequences still stand? So I'm telling you is, be careful. Consequences can follow, even with forgiveness, okay? Consequences can follow. And these people were that way. Now, let me go back and just hit some other things here. I want to deal with this issue. Did God change his mind? In verse 12, he says, I will strike them down and make you into a greater nation. Moses prays for seven verses. Moses prays, and then in verse 20, God says, I've forgiven them as you asked. I won't wipe them out. I was going to send a plague and destroy them and raise you into a nation. I won't do that now, Moses. I will forgive them as you asked. Did God change his mind here? So my statement is, can God change his mind? Okay? And I want to suggest that God can change his mind. Okay? 23:19 is what you're looking for. Anyways, so can God change his mind? And the suggestion is here that yes, God changed his mind here. Okay? By the way, can you change your mind? Can you change your mind? Question, can you do something God can't do? You say, well, yeah, I can sin. God can't sin. Okay, now I'm talking just about changing one's mind. It's not right or wrong. If you can change your mind and God can't change his mind, then do you see what I'm saying? That's something. Did God change his mind here? I'm going to wipe them out. Moses prayed. That tells us a whole lot of things about prayer too, doesn't it? Tells us a whole lot of things. Does prayer make a difference? When I was younger, I was taught prayer. You pray not because you're going to change the mind of God. You pray because you just want to be obedient to God. You pray because God has commanded you to pray. Is Moses praying here because God commanded him to pray? Or is Moses praying because he wants to make a difference? And he wants to. Does Moses want to change the mind of God on this issue? Yes, he does. And so he pleads with God, God, you can't do this. And he pleads with God, okay? And so I'm saying, does prayer make a difference? I want to say, Moses prayed to God, and eight verses later, God says, okay, I will forgive them as you asked. And what I'm trying to tell you is prayer very, very significant? Do you realize in prayer that we can address the God of the universe? The God of the universe, Samuel, God listens. God listens. There's times, to be honest with you, I've been very boring persons. There's times I can't even get my wife to listen to me. God, the God of made the universe listens. And he responds then by saying, okay, I won't wipe them out. I will forgive them as you asked. Okay, this brings up this huge debate. The huge debate, okay, yes, sir. Okay. Okay. All right. So we change our mind. We change our mind on the basis of what we were going to do before was a mistake. We change it to a better option. Okay. So God changes his mind, and then that was a mistake. But that contradicts who, so God can't change then. I see where you're going with that. Right, he can't. So how can he change his mind? Okay, does everybody hear that? If God is perfect, then how can God change his mind? Because God certainly was unable to make a mistake. I think, let me tackle it this way. I think you're thinking about the perfect or the good as singular. What happens if the good is multiple? That rather than changing, have you ever changed your mind not because one was wrong and one was right, but because there were two goods there and you could have picked either one and you picked one and versus the other? Or maybe not even better. Maybe you decided to choose the other one just for to choose the other one. So what I'm suggesting is that there may be multiple goods and that God can pick good one, good two, good three, good four. And that maybe the perfect isn't the perfect, but maybe there's possibly multiple perfects out there that, could get God from one, point A to point B. Okay? And so that's what I'm suggesting here, that maybe the future is not singular, but maybe the future has potential in terms of possibilities, and that there are multiple possibilities. In other words, can God accomplish his purpose? And can he accomplish that purpose through multiple ways of accomplishing it? And then if you allow for those possibilities, does human freedom, does that allow for human freedom then? And does it also allow for God to interact with human beings then as far as how that future will be shaped? Now, Hannah, I need you to pull that 23:19. Did anybody do Malachi? But anyways, she's going to read a verse. She's going to contradict me here. No, don't like what I said now. Then I got to contradict myself. Okay.
Oh,
all right. I'll contradict myself. Here. Look in your Bible to chapter 23, verse 19, staying in the book of Numbers. We could go over to Malachi and do the same type of thing. In Numbers chapter 23, verse 19, it says, God is not a man that he should lie, nor the son of man that he should change his mind. So that seems to contradict what I just said, right? That God cannot change his mind because he's not a man. Yes, Hannah.
But this is what I like about what you said, because the mayor said that the way men change their minds is different from the way God changes his mind. So you could say God is not a son of man that he should change his mind. Impossible for that sons of man to change their mind.
Yeah. So that maybe there's a difference in how God changes his mind as far as humans change their mind. The suggestion over here is we change our mind when something is wrong and we change to something is better. Is it possible that God changes his mind between multiple goods and then opens up possibility? Now, when can God not change? Can God not change when he's given us his promise? When he's promised something, does God have to keep his promise? So he can't change his mind when he's promised something. But question, does every time God open his mouth, is it always a promise? Every time you open your mouth, is it a promise? Can you make promises? Can you make promises? Yes, you can make promises. But how much of your life is promises? By the way, is some of your life promises? Yeah, but do you often talk in other ways and in all sorts, express yourself in all sorts of different ways? So what I'm suggesting here is that what this passage is saying is that when God gives us his word, he can't change his word because he's made a promise. So he's told Abraham, Abraham, I'm going to give you the land, the seed, and the blessing. And so God can't change that. However, how God gives Abraham the land, the seed, and the blessing, the how of that, can that change into all sorts of different ways that God could do that? Jesus has to be born in Bethlehem of Judea. Does Jesus have to be born in Bethlehem? Micah chapter 5, verse 2 says the Messiah has got to be born in Bethlehem of Judea. Question, when Joseph and Mary come down, is it possible they could have gone down to Jericho and come up to Jerusalem? Or is it possible they could have gone through Samaria and gone to Jerusalem? Is it possible they could have gone out to the Philistine plain and come up to Jerusalem? Are there many ways that they could have gotten to Bethlehem? And what God is saying is, no, Jesus will be born in Bethlehem, and basically how you get there, whatever, you know? And so allows for flexibility and human choice. Yes? Okay, yeah. Is everybody here? What he's asking, and actually I ask you to look at those passages, especially with Saul. God comes to Saul, I think it's in chapter 13 of 1 Samuel or thereabouts. think it's 13, 15, something like that. God comes to Saul, King Saul, and he says, Saul, if you would have obeyed me, I would have made your descendants kings over Israel forever. If you would obey me. And what I'm suggesting here is, let me just put it this way in philosophical terms. Can God do an if statement? Can God do an if statement? If you do this, then I will do this. But if you do this, then I will do this. Can God do conditionals? Can God do conditionals? And if then? And can he have multiple if then? If they do this, I will do this. If they do this. And in a passage in Saul's case, exactly the case. He says, Saul, if you had, I would have made your descendants kings over Israel forever. But you didn't. And therefore, I'm going to search after a man after my own heart, which is David. Okay? So there, God clearly had two paths. Saul made the choice, and then God responds. And David becomes king. So yeah, that passage in 1 Samuel is great. There's another great one in chapter 15 on the city of Keilah that we'll, when we get there, I'll go over it and stuff. But so what I'm suggesting is that there's conditionality with God. Not everything is fixed with God. Now, by the way, are certain things fixed with God? There's certain things that are fixed, and there are other things that are not fixed. And so, by the way, does that allow then for possibility, multiplicity, and allows for human freedom in these things getting put together? Now, you said, Hildebrandt, are you saying that you solve the, you know, free will versus predestination problem? And the answer is no. The honest truth is what I'm trying to do is confuse you. Okay? Yes, sir. Jake? Pardon? Okay. Okay, tell me about the perfect woman. Singular or plural? Non-existent, that's what he said. All right, that was a dumb question. Okay, that was a bad one. Let me do another direction. But you know what I'm saying? Is it possible there's multiple perfects? You don't think so? Okay, I think there are. So how are you going to prove that? I mean, you know what I'm saying? We're debating things that it's hard to know. Because he's God, because I think God, how should I say, is big enough. I don't have to, actually, now that question I don't have to answer. How can God deal with conditionals? All I'm doing is I'm citing Scripture. Actually, what he did was cite Scripture. God gave an if to Saul and said, Saul, if you had obeyed me, I would have made you king forever. God himself says that. So now I'm not dealing with my conjecture of multiple perfects. I'm dealing with, that's what the Bible says. And if God says it, then I say, well, okay, apparently he can handle conditionals. Okay? If, Saul, if you had obeyed me, then you would have been king forever. But since you hadn't, now David's in the scene. Okay? So God himself uses conditionals of ifs statements. By the way, I would say that the conditional goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden too, as well. There's a tree in the garden. If you eat it, you're good. If you eat it, you're bad. You're out of here. And if you don't eat it, you're good, man. I'll be here with you guys forever. So I think right from the beginning, this if statement with human beings, and my guess is that the if statement then comes from our Father, who also makes choices. And now, by the way, is it okay to disagree on this issue? By the way, I'm not trying to convince anybody. I'm basically trying to, and you say, why are you trying to confuse us? Let me just explain about confusion, how confusion can work. Is it possible that a professor can confuse students to try to break them away from God and to show fallacies in the Bible and show all this stuff negative and stuff and confuse students to break down their religion? Is that what I'm trying to do with this? And the answer is no. I am trying to confuse you, but what I'm trying to confuse you for is that you move from thinking that you know something that you don't know to saying God is wonderful, that God is full of wonder. And the wonder, rather than saying what? It's kind of like, you know, I can't understand you. I can't understand you, and I'm out of here. I just can't understand you, and bailing out. Is another way to go to some like I would do with my wife, who we've been married for over 36 years. Question, do I understand my wife? No. And so I come into this woman's head, and I say, I just do not understand. I mean, 26 years, you'd think I'd have a clue by now. And it's, I don't understand you. Now, question, if I go, I don't understand you, and bail out like that, is that one move? Is another move to come and say, You are wonderful. I don't understand you. Please help me understand you. Is that a movement towards someone in love? And what I'm saying is God is wonderful. And that wonder, that confusion should attract us to him to say, man, I want to explore. I want to know more about God. I want to be able to trace his thoughts to see how God moves, to see what God loves, what he doesn't like, what he does like, how he thinks about things. And that wonder, then the wonder attracts us. The wonder attracts us to a devotion to him and a pursuit. Actually, the wonder causes us to pursue God. Do you see like that? Does that make sense? Rather than the confusion. But what happens is if we think we know about God, then what? If we think we know, do we pursue? No, because then we're okay with what we know. We feel comfortable with when I was younger, you know, I was in one position, and then I keep reading these scriptures where God is so dynamic and stuff. And so I've moved more toward the dynamic. But how should I say, a lot of my best friends and things are really into, you know, the predestination and that kind of thing. And I've kind of moved away from it over the years because of largely texts like this. Now, by the way, if you want ways out of the my way of thinking about things or others' ways of thinking about things, you can say that God here is just, he knew ahead of time that Moses was going to pray. He knew ahead of time Moses was going to pray. So this whole thing was put, so he says, Moses, I'm going to wipe him out, because he wanted Moses to stand up for the people. He knew that Moses was going to pray, and God knew that he was not going to wipe him out. So he was doing it more for Moses' development. Does everybody see that? So that God here is saying, I know what I'm going to do already. Moses prays to me. Hey, I know this already. I'm just doing it so that he'll pray to me, that he'll become a better man. But question, is any of that in the text here? Or did we just make that up? We just made that up. That's not in the text. That's conjecture. Okay? Now, the other way to work with it, that's one way to work with it, and it's possible. I don't know. It's possible. Another way to say is that we as human beings cannot understand God. So God portrays himself like a human being. He portrays himself like a human being so we can understand him. So it looks like God changed his mind. He never really changed his mind. God is portraying himself in anthropomorphic. Have you ever heard that term? Anthropomorphic. He anthropomorphizes himself. God puts himself in human terms so we can understand him. Okay? And that's used also for these kind of passages to say God is just telling us a human way of looking at it. It's not really the way God really is. But again, I don't buy that, because are we made in the image of God? Can we understand a whole lot about God? Now, having said all that, let me jump to, this is my favorite passage on this whole discussion. And I think it's Isaiah chapter 40, verse 28. Isaiah chapter 40 is one of the most incredible chapters in the Bible. And in Isaiah chapter 40, he says this. Do you not know? This is Isaiah chapter 40, verse 28. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary. Beautiful verse, right? He will not grow tired or weary. And then it says this. And his understanding no one can fathom. And his understanding no one can fathom. And that tells me, question, are we going to ever figure this thing out? And the answer is no. It really works good for bull sessions, going half the night discussing different people from different perspectives. But no one, God says, understands my understanding. Yeah, Hannah?
But you just said we can understand a lot about God.
We can understand a lot about God, okay? But what he's saying is, okay, do we say we can understand nothing about God? We can't say that either, because he's revealed himself in his word, so we can understand what he's meaning is we cannot understand completely about God. We can't encompass God with our thoughts. Can we make idols of God in our mind? In other words, that we get comfortable with how we think about God in our minds, and our minds then become idols. In other words, we have idols of God in our minds. They're boxes in which we contain God in our minds. And what I'm wanting to do is blow those boxes away to say, God should raise mystery and wonder that attracts you to pursue him for the rest of your life. It's exciting. Yes, Jake. Yeah. 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 Some of the contradictions, like with the Moses thing, it was a translation problem. And those are, to be honest with you, those are fairly easy because you just know Hebrew. It's not a big deal. You get it and stuff. Other contradictions will be, there'll be other things that are logical contradictions that you can work through. There'll be different types of solutions. Some of them will be cultural solutions, you know, difference in culture. Some of them will be difference in language. And those we can work with. There's other big ones in Scripture, like predestination versus free will, that nobody's, you know, we're stumped. And I think at that point that's when you move to the wonder and mystery thing. That you gotta, in a certain sense, you gotta realize your own humanity, that we're finite, God is infinite. And the finite then, there's always going to be stuff. Now, by the way, can finite understand some of the infinite? Yes, okay, we can map some of it on the infinite, but there's going to be parts of the infinite that are totally, you know what I'm saying, they may come around the back side of you, and you have no clue that it's back there, but it's really part of the infinite that's around you. And so, at a certain point, you got to, there's a humility needed to say, yeah, his understanding is unfathomable. And that leads me to pursue him more. It doesn't lead me to giving up. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't lead me to giving up. It leads me to pursuing God more. And not to pursue him, to contain him, and to exhaustively understand him, but rather to explore the wonders of God. Okay? So, yeah. Okay. Now, let's get through this Korah rebellion stuff. Chapter 16 in the book of Numbers is Korah's rebellion. Let me just kind of explain this and talk through this. Chapter 16, Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, these guys are Levites. They're Levites that come to Moses and say, Moses, you and Aaron aren't such big hot stuff. We're Levites too. We want to be special to God. We want to be, when I say special to God, what word comes to mind? What is the word that makes special to God? The word holy? We're holy to God too. We're separated to God too. And so basically this demand to be special or separated, Korah comes to Moses and says, hey, we want some of those rights that you have as leaders and thing. And so this is kind of how it goes down. In this narrative, Moses does something that he rarely does anywhere else. Normally, when people come at Moses, then, you know, God steps in and God gets angry, I'm going to wipe him out kind of thing. Here, Moses himself gets angry at the people. And in chapter 16, verse 15, then Moses became very angry and said to the Lord, do not accept their offering. Moses is now, is he praying for the people or against the people? Yeah, he's saying, don't accept their offering. So here, Moses is taking a new role. This is the role of the anti-mediator. Rather, normally Moses is the mediator between God and his people. But in this role, he's anti-mediator. God, don't accept their offerings. Don't accept their sacrifices and stuff. Does God have a sense of humor? Well, this is kind of an ironic sense of humor. God comes to Korah and Dathan and says, you guys want to be separated. You want to be special? You want to be separated? Okay, separate all your people over here. The rest of the Israelites are over here. You guys separate over here. And God says, and then I'll separate you. I'll separate you permanently. The ground opens up, swallows them all up, wham, bam, down into the grave. And so it's God that says, you want to be separated? I'll separate you. It's kind of like Miriam. Miriam, you like white? Miriam, you want to be white? Okay, I'll make you totally white. Okay? And here, you know, you want to be separated? Okay, I'll separate you. The ground opens up and swallows them all up. And Korah, Dathan, and Abiram go down with their stuff into the pit. This has to do with power struggles among leaders and people. When you have a leader, well, people under the leader sometimes undermine the leader and project all sorts of bad motives on the leader and that kind of thing. And what this passage just warns is Moses is a leader. And when these people come to say, Moses, we don't think you're so hot. We want to be like, have all the privileges you have and stuff like that. God says, no, Moses is my man. He's the leader. And so you got to be careful. You got to be careful about undermining leaders and making bad statements and things. And this passage is kind of one of those passages. To continue this on, Moses takes on this new role as the anti-mediator rather than the mediator. All through the book of Numbers, he's mediated on behalf, he's prayed for on behalf of the people. And the mediatory role is really important. Have you guys ever prayed for somebody? Have you guys ever prayed for somebody where it really, really matters? I pray. I've got four kids, and I prayed for my kids. I only prayed one for prayer for my kids, okay? It's always been like this. I told God right from the start. I said, I'm going to have one prayer for my kids for all their life. I pray one prayer. I'm a very simple person, and I just, okay, God, I got one prayer. This is my prayer for my kids. All of it's the same prayer every day. I pray that my kids grow up to love God with all their heart. I figure if they love God with all their heart, the rest of life takes care of itself. And I said, God, I want my kids to grow up to love you with all their heart. I'm lying. Last year, right at this time, I reneged on that. My son was in Afghanistan, and he said every day they went out, they got shot at. He had friends that were blown to smithereens, that he had to pick up parts of them and other things. Okay, really, I shouldn't even let that get out of there. But anyway, stuff that he says that he hopes he can forget. And that he never wants to remember. Stuff he saw, he said, Dad, I've seen stuff that no human being should ever see. I've seen stuff. And it was really bad. And I prayed to God last year at this time that that he grows up to love him with all his heart. But I said, God, I got one other thing. My son, I don't want him getting killed over there. It's like, you know, the old man's supposed to go first, you know, and the kid. So please, God, spare his life. And I prayed that God spare his life. Question, did I pray that God spared his life? Or did I beg God to spare his life? I begged. Okay? And I just want to tell you, I learned a lot about prayer last year. And by the way, did God spare his life? God spared his life. His head's all messed up, but God spared. That was a sick joke anyways. But no, he came back. When you come back out of that stuff, is there a lot of stuff going down in his head? And we talk every night. I'll be probably talking to him tonight and stuff like that. We talk for hours and hours and work through a lot of the stuff that he's still unsettled with. But anyways, what I'm saying is, does prayer change things? And that's. Now Moses, this guy's a prophet. He makes a short-term prophecy. There's short-term prophecies and long-term prophecies. Moses says, if I am the prophet of God, Korah, and you're attacking me, If I am a true prophet of God, the ground is going to open up and swallow you down. Guess what happens? He's a true prophet of God. Does the prophet's word get fulfilled? Yes. And it says basically they opened up and they get swallowed down. Moses is shown to be a true prophet. He's shown to be a true prophet because his word comes true exactly the way he said it. So basically the ground opens up, 1633, swallows them down into the pit. And they went down alive into the grave, the NIV translates it. This word grave is the Hebrew word sheol. Sheol is like the underworld. It's kind of a murky term. It's very hard to figure out exactly. It means the grave. It means like a physical grave, but it also means the grave beyond that, like of people and murky world where the realm of shadows and the afterlife kind of thing. And it's a complex word. But here it just means opens up the ground, boom, they died and they were into the grave kind of thing. Yeah.
Did the Jewish people traditionally have a different view of hell?
Did the Jewish people have a different view of hell than we do? It's hard to know exactly what their view of hell was, because I think their view of hell has also changed over time. Back in these kind of days, it's really murky. They did not have very much of a view of the afterlife. You know what I'm saying? There's not a lot of view. You guys have read a lot of the Old Testament now. Is there a lot of talk about heaven?
No
really. What have you guys read about heaven and stuff? It's like this, okay? And so the same thing with hell. It wasn't really a clear thing. By the time you get into Jesus in the New Testament, there seems to be much more data in the New Testament going to a place where the worm dieth not, where the fire, you know, burned up and stuff. So there does seem to be foreshadows of it, like Sodom and Gomorrah burning and things like that, place of burning and torment, that kind of thing. But it's real murky in the Old Testament. And largely it's based off that word sheol. It's sometimes the word sheol just simply means they put the guy on the ground and he's in the grave. And then other times it has this more expansive thing. So it's really tough in the Old Testament. And I don't think there's a unitary. In other words, it was always this way it was conceptualized in the Old Testament. If I'm not mistaken in this, that you actually see a development of the Jews' understanding and then coming up to the time of Christ. It's still in the process of change. So that's a really good question. Yeah.
Wouldn't it make more sense to be hell, because hell is permanent separation from God?
Yeah, hell we usually view as permanent separation from God. But the problem is with this term is sometimes this term just means the afterlife. And doesn't mean heaven or hell. You know, as you have, I don't know, it's mixed. It's a mixed up term. So while we make very clear, sharp distinctions, the Jewish people at this time, the distinctions are not clear as far as what they understood of the afterlife. So I want to kind of just leave it murky like that, because that's, to be honest, truth, that's the way it is back then. Yeah. Jake, and then we better get down. Yeah. Well, you want to clarify it? You can clarify. Okay. Limbo, yeah. And that's maybe limbo. It's like a modern term and stuff, but that's not a bad term. That it's, that, in other words, it is limbo, that it's not differentiated. Like, it's not, you know what I'm saying? It's not differentiated. It's That there's something bothers me about the term limbo, because it's such a modern term. But I think there's an aspect of that's right. That it's, the problem is the context. Let me go back to what determines the meaning of this word sheol? The context. Some context, it means they just put them in the grave. You know what I'm saying? Nothing more. Others will be this limbo, we'll use that term, area that's undifferentiated afterlife. Maybe that's the way to say it. Undifferentiated afterlife, limbo. Okay, good. All right. Now, some people never learn. After these people get swallowed up, what happens in verse 41 here? It says, the next day the whole Israelite community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. You have killed the Lord's people, they said. And what happens? God says, hey, we'll fry them too. And Moses, now Moses switches roles. He says, God, don't do it. And basically, these people never learn. So my question after this is, we've asked the question, can God change? Here's another question that I have. By the way, this is a dead serious question. Can people change? Is change hard? Now you say, you know, I'm a young lady and I love this guy and he's got all sorts of problems. Dad, he's got all sorts of problems, but I can help fix them. So I can change. I can change him. I can change him and things. Yeah, some people are shaking their heads because they don't exactly. Yeah, right. Question. Do people, I am dead serious. Is change in a person at core levels almost impossible? Now, you say, now I come back to Eric had it right in the years. Can the Holy Spirit change the core of a person? Yes, the answer is yes. But question, is core change in a person really, really hard? Now, by the way, can a good woman change a man? I've seen that happen too. Is it really rare? Okay, really rare. So I'm saying be careful. I mean, when my daughters, when a young woman comes to me and says, you know, I'm going to change this guy, all in the back of my head, I'm smirking, saying, naive, I'm sorry. But and I would never call anybody naive. But I'm sure thinking, you know what I'm saying, it's changing. I know a guy, I want to use another example. We'll change that because it's on tape. But it just, I know a guy who wanted to quit smoking. Now, question, is smoking a pretty simple thing, right? You buy cigarettes and you smoke cigarettes. Question, can people change? You say, yeah, he can change. This guy changed people's lives and stuff. Question, could he quit smoking? No. Okay. And you say that they lasted for, what, 50, 60 years. Okay. Can it, and what I'm saying is change is really hard for people. Did you know people that have heart bypass surgery? Heart bypass surgery, and they know they've got to change what they eat and they got to start exercising. Do you know that after people have major open heart surgery, 2 years later, over 90% of those people are doing the same thing they were doing beforehand? Can people change? You know what I'm saying? It's scary when you think about it. Now, by the way, are you guys in an age of change? You're growing up and your things and a lot of things changing. What happens? You hit about 25, you kind of fossilize. Actually, the honest truth, you kind of change all your life. And so it's interesting, you know, what I'm saying is you blink, and how old are you guys now? 18, 19 years old. How fast did your life go by? Pretty fast. You blink again, and all of a sudden you'll be 25, graduated from Gordon College in a career. You blink again, and you'll be 35, and you'll have kids and things. And then all of a sudden you blink again. He says, stop. And then, wait a minute, you blink one more time, you blink, and you're stinking old man like me. And you're...
Don't blink.
And that is the conclusion. Does anybody know that country song? The conclusion is, don't blink. And anyway, so I think, is there a point to that? But what's the point of that song, and what's the point of the stuff? Does life go by really fast? Does life go by really fast? And by the way, what does that, how does this fit into this? Do you see how this fits into this? Life goes by really fast. Can things change? Who are the agents of change? Can you choose and shape your future? Can you make choices that change the future? The world is out there. We live in an day and age now that's incredible. As much as I hate to use it because of these stupid Mac computers and stuff, but Steve Jobs died. Question, did he make a difference in the world in a big way? And what I'm saying is, some of you people here are able, you're going to be able to make choices in the future and things like that. You can change the world. And I guess my thing is to get a vision of that. Carpe diem, man. Make it happen. Try your best. Make the choices you can to be the best person you can. Change the world for good. Are there people who are wanting to change the world for evil? You guys, get the vision. Change. Make choices. Daily choices. Does that mean you got to get up when it's 5:30 in the morning and you got to do your work? No, it's easier to sleep in. Question, do you get up? You get up. You do your work. You go after it. What I'm saying is make choices that's going to make you the kind of person that can change the world for good. We live in an incredible day today in which people have, there's just all these choices in front of you guys, man. It's like a smorgasbord. And what I'm telling you is go for it. Go for it. Make a difference in the world for good. Commit yourself to good yourself and then, bam, make those choices. So anyways, can people really change? Yeah. Now, what about Moses hitting the rock? You say, here, Moses even blew it, hitting the rock. I think a lot of people miss in chapter 20 with Moses. A lot of people in this chapter with Moses striking the rock, and this is where Moses has a sin, actually, and God nails him for it. People always skip this. How does chapter 20, where Moses strikes the rock and he commits a sin and he's judged for it, how does this chapter start? In the first month, the whole Israelite community arrived at the desert of Zin and they stayed at Kadesh. There, Miriam died and was buried. The chapter opens in the first verse with the death of Miriam. Is this a big thing for Moses? Was Miriam his older sister? Was Miriam the older sister when Moses was floating down in a basket and stuff that helped train him and stuff like that? Miriam, his sister, died. By the way, how does chapter 20 end? The story of Aaron's death. So chapter 20, and then Moses in the middle of chapter 20, what does he do? He strikes the rock. Is chapter 20 like a really bad day for Moses? Okay, his sister dies, his brother dies, and he strikes the rock. Okay, so this is one of the chapters. If I were writing the Pentateuch, this is one I would have kind of like left out and things. But anyways, this is Moses. He goes to the rock, and God tells him to go to the rock and speak to the rock, and water will come out. Why did God nail Moses so hard just for hitting a rock? Why did God judge Moses so hard just for hitting the rock? What's wrong with hitting a rock? Is there anything inherently wrong with hitting a rock with a stick to get water? As a matter of fact, in the book of Exodus, did Moses strike a rock, rod on a rock to get water? So is there anything inherently wrong with what he did? The answer is no. Okay, so let me just run through this. Okay, what was wrong with hitting a rock? There was nothing wrong with hitting a rock. The act itself, there was nothing wrong with the act, except the real issue doesn't have to do with hitting the rock. The real issue is found in verse 12. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you did not trust in me enough to honor me as holy in the sight of the Israelites, you will not bring this community into the land I give them. Moses is going to wander with them for 40 years. Moses is going to wander. This is the Dead Sea, right? Sea of Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea. He's going to wander in the desert for 40 years. He's going to come up along the side here, and right where Eric is, Moses can't cross the Jordan River. And so on Mount Nebo here, Moses is going to go up to the mountain. He's going to die. Is he going to be able to look over the mountain? He's going to be able to look and see Israel, but he can't go over there. God says, you struck the rock. Why? Because you did not trust. Because you did not trust me. Is trust and faith a big deal? Is trust and faith a big deal? This is what Christianity is all about. This is it. Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him for righteousness. Here, Moses did not trust God. And by the way, our leaders judge. Does God judge the thoughts and intents of a person's heart? God, you may not be able to judge those thoughts and intents, but God weighs the thoughts and intents of the heart, and Moses' heart was not right here. And what he did physically was nothing wrong with it, but his heart was wrong. He didn't do it in trusting. The other problem is the responsibility of leaders. Our leaders judged more severely than common folk. Leaders are judged more difficultly or hard, more severely than regular people. The book of James tells us that and other things. I always have this nightmare that I have that I've died and go to heaven, and all my students that you guys are coming by and like St. Peter's got me off to the side saying you can't go into heaven and stuff, and I'm watching and all my students are going into heaven, and he's saying, Hildebrand, remember all those crazy things you said in class about me not changing my mind? Well, I changed my mind now. Stay outside here and let all your students go in. So as you guys are trucking on in and stuff like that, just you could wave at me and stuff and say, and maybe one of you guys could be like mediator and say, hey, please let them in. It's okay. But the honest truth is, when you're up here talking all the time, do I say a lot of things that are crazy and stupid? And I frankly worry about that someday I got a judgment for all the dumb things I said in front of class. Oh, man, I can't. Anyways, so all I'm saying is when you take a position of leadership, is there another responsibility level? When you take a position of leadership, there's another responsibility level, and you got to be aware of that and be careful and stuff. Moses blew it and stuff. And then lastly, is there consequences for actions? Do your actions have consequences? This is one of the fundamental things about wisdom. That actions, there are consequences for actions. And what's really neat is, can there be positive consequences for actions? Can you do good things and then have good consequences? And there's negative things, you can do negative consequences and stuff. So there are consequences. And what does that tell us? Does today matter? Do the things you do today, do they matter? Yes, today matters. The things that you do matter. It makes a difference. And so my thing is, life is so rich. You know, grab each day, man. Each day matters. The things you do. Moses, what would happen if he missed that day that he struck the rock? He would have gotten into promised land, okay? But he made some bad decisions that day, and it affected the next 40 years of his life. So, okay. Bronze snake in a pole. Do this one quickly. The people complain again in Numbers chapter 21. The people complain again. And what happens? God sends venomous snakes out, and the snakes start biting the people. Now, how does he get out of it? He puts a bronze snake on a pole and holds it up and says, you need to look at this snake that bit you. You look at the pole. You look and live. Does anybody remember that song, Look and Live, My Brother Live? Anyways, they used to have an old gospel hymn that went there, look and live. And so at this. But this isn't really why this is so important, because guess what? In the New Testament, Jesus is talking to this guy Nicodemus, and here's how this goes. Jesus in the New Testament is talking to Nicodemus. He says, no one has ever gone up into heaven except the one who came down from heaven. Who came down from heaven? The Son of Man. Nicodemus, just as Moses lifted up the snake in the desert, so the Son of Man must be lifted up. As the snake was lifted up in the desert, so the Son of Man must be lifted up, that everyone who believes in him may have eternal life. Why? For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life. That snake on the pole, what does that tell us? Does that tell us how much God loves us? The snake on the pole becomes the Son of Man, who is God's Son, who is crucified on our behalf, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish. That snake on the pole is the setup for John 3:16. The snake on the pole is a setup for John 3:16, where Jesus is now saying the Son of Man is going to be put on a pole. And whoever believes in him, eternal life. It's incredible. God loves us. And each day counts. Let's do it. All right. End of class. See you guys.
This is Dr. Ted Hildebrandt in his Old Testament History, Literature, and Theology course, lecture number 15 on the book of Numbers.